welcome to Comfortably Unnumb, the official podcast of the Umbrella Society. My name is Blake Anderson. I'm the programs manager here at Umbrella Society and also the host of this podcast. Coming to you today from beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the traditional unceded territories of the Lekwungen-speaking people of the Songhees and Wasanik Nations. Well, this season is almost a wrap. Just as we are starting to feel spring in these parts and the sun is making its presence felt, we are getting down to our last couple of podcasts of the season. I'm incredibly proud of everyone who's participated in the podcast this year, and I'm still blown away by the reach it has had in our community. These are absolutely inspirational stories that we need to hear as they remind us both that recovery is possible, but also that every recovery journey is a very unique and individual process. So as we wind down this season, I'm reflecting, back upon it, and I'm absolutely thrilled by the amount of strong women that we've had on the program this year. Our last two guests, Alicia and Stephanie, are both proud mothers in recovery. And today, yet again, we have another mother on the program. I'm happy to welcome Amy today as our guest. Amy is a fairly new employee here at Umbrella Society who is working a strong recovery program and has quite the story. Amy talks about the realities of being a mother in active addiction and the hard work that she put in so that she can be the strong role model for her son and daughter. Amy is a great example of someone who is working hard to break the cycle of addiction so that she can describe a different path for her and for her kids. So very happy to have her here with us today. Okay, Amy, thank you so much for coming on this program. We've been really wanting to have you on. I actually had a couple of your coworkers, members of Umbrella here that actually called me up and said, you got to get Amy on this program. I think your story, is really inspirational. And I think just, they saw it and how you could, be so relatable with the clients that you were working with. And so, yeah, really, really happy that you had the courage to come on here. I know it takes a lot. So thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So, yeah, I would love to dive back a little bit and, just get a little bit of a history on how things kind of came to be. Substances sounds like were part of your life at a really early age, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I believe that I really kind of noticed that substances were like a big part of our family at the age of five. I think my mom and dad both struggled with substance use, and it does go back quite a bit in our family line. I believe I was quite empathetic and aware at a young age, and just seeing my dad struggle so much and going back and forth from mom and dad's constantly. And, I was always worried about him and wondering if he was okay. I didn't really remember my mom drinking very much when I was younger. It was more kind of like my dad's drinking that kind of raised more concerns to me. Sure. I spent weeks with mom and then I'd go to dad's on the weekends.
Was that kind of from the get-go or?
Yeah.
It was just, they were split up?
They split when I was three. Okay. And both kind of started dating my soon-to-be step-parents when I was 5 years old. Both my step-parents were phenomenal, very stable individuals and kind of really kept that structure alive in my life. Okay. But like I said, I witnessed a lot when I'd go over to dad's with the way he was with my stepmom or girlfriend at the time. And it really concerned me. I think I was always a daddy's girl. So I just really like cared for him and worried about his well-being.
And that must have been such a hard experience at such a young age. I'm sure you couldn't fully process or understand what was going on.
No.
You probably knew that something was not right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, seeing him so emotional and acting out and being very kind of verbally abusive when intoxicated was really hard to see because that's not the dad that I knew. Right. My dad was a very, very kind, genuine soul and really put his heart out there. He coached a women's softball team. So I think, a lot of drinking kind of went alongside with that.
Sure.
My stepdad with my mom on my mom's side of things was a good man and really like kept me going with sports and stuff and took us on vacations. So like I really, really grew close to him. I think I absolutely was a daddy's girl and really just was concerned about my dad. Also, too, like back then, they would argue about money, child support, that kind of stuff. Right. So that was kind of like on my shoulders.
Well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And which shouldn't be kind of what a child has to deal with. So there wasn't a very good relationship between my mom and dad. And I think I also sensed that and felt that as well. So
was, you know, your dad's substance use or your mom's substance, was it ever discussed or talked to you?
Like, no, it was kind of just like shoved under the carpet, like, you know, or under the rug. You just never really talked about it. There was no discussion. What happened. And then the next day we just kind of had to carry on like nothing really happened.
And I think actually, you know, talking about substances and getting on the table, that this is kind of like a new thing, you know, like back, you know, in the day, that really wasn't something that happened. This is a kind of a recent development, right? So yeah, it was back in the day, that's just something that wasn't talked about the same way. Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. As I got older, I think just like the fear and anger, seeing it and not talking about it, I at 13 was when I really started to experiment with alcohol.
Okay.
It was never like super bad at that time per se. I mean, obviously I believe that the first drink I took, I was alcoholic just because I liked the way it felt. I felt a lot of relief. Okay. And I blacked out the very first time I drank,
right.
Which obviously is an indication that maybe there's a problem.
Right. But at 13, that's not.
No, of course.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you recognized, oh man, this is something that you like the feeling of the oblivion, absolutely. Essentially, and the relief. Okay.
Totally. I think, so we'll go back a little bit. I was an only child up until 9, and then my dad and my stepmom had my sister, and that was a really exciting thing for me.
Yeah, I think bet.
Just because, you know, I spent all those years alone and, becoming a big sister was a big deal, but I think just, I don't know. I think it was a part of me that just wanted connection. I couldn't wait to have like a sibling or somebody that, you know, I could be close with because I felt so alone a lot of the times, like within my family, with the dysfunction of alcohol use.
Right.
Then at around 10, my mom and dad both had children with their partners. I had my other two sisters come into the world I became a sister to 3 sisters.
Okay.
And that was pretty exciting for me. They were my world.
Right.
I feel like I was kind of like a guardian at 10.
What an age to have, you know, babies kind of come into your life too, right?
Yeah. They were my everything. I mean, being a big sister is still very special to me. I love my sisters with all my heart. But down the line a little bit, my mom and my stepdad split up when I was 15 years old.
Okay.
And I think that really like spun my world a little bit. I felt, like I said before, a lot of structure with my stepdad.
Right.
He was kind of, you know, he didn't drink.
He was like, right.
That he was just, it was stable. Exactly. No disrespect to my dad, but that's, I think, what a kid needs, right?
Yep,
you need to feel stable. You need to have discipline and rules. And it's just that structure, right? So when that happened, my world just started spinning. And
what was your drinking kind of between 13 and 15, or is it just kind of like the weekend?
It was just experimenting,
like, right? But it wasn't out of control, going from 0 to 100, anything like that.
I will say I was a little boy crazy. I don't know if that has to do with maybe my relationship with my dad and, you know, substance use and stuff. I was always just trying to look for comfort and love and belonging, I think, and always looking in the wrong places, I guess.
Sure.
But at 16, I was with a partner and ended up unfortunately getting pregnant and had to have an abortion. And I feel like that kind of set me on that trajectory of spiraling a little bit with my substances.
So all of a sudden the substance use is amplified.
And I mean I was young, right? So 16, people talk, you know, the word gets out that somebody's having an abortion. It was humiliating.
Right. Yeah,
it was really really hard. And then eventually I dropped out of dance. I was dancing ever since I was 3.
Okay.
And it really was a place where I could express myself. I really could open up and let my emotions out.
Okay.
It was very much a passion of mine. And once I stopped dancing, it was when, you know, things really blew up.
Gotcha.
Dropped out of school.
This huge outlet and probably the structure as well. Mm-hmm. Like I was lucky to play sports growing up. And it does kind of keep you it kind of forces your hand to kind of have a little bit of structure in your life, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Dance was everything to me. I had a great set of friends. I had dance teachers I looked up to. And I think once I lost, you know, those relationships, it just kind of put me down a different path of meeting people that maybe, you know, weren't as healthy for me.
What was your kind of justification to putting dance aside? Was it, you know, to do with the abortion? Or was it?
To be honest, yeah. I think I had so much shame. Right. First, because, you know, abortion's kind of frowned upon. Mm-hmm. Second, just because, like, I mean, I was 16 and going through that was really, really, really hard on me emotionally, right? Like, right. I still to this day think about that. It's hard. It's a big decision that you have to make.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have, you know, the support because mom's addiction really kind of lifted off once that divorce happened.
Right.
Right.
So your mom all of a sudden is okay. So her
addiction started to surface a little bit. Yeah. Okay. I didn't notice it as much with her when I was young. She really held it together. Great woman.
I guess when you have your stepdad who's doesn't
no know, he didn't drink that, he was very right, structured
so
yeah right,
okay
yeah
so all of a sudden he's out of the picture and so she's going through her own struggles
yeah it was okay. A huge loss for me. I was really lost. I ended up finishing with Colquitt's middle school and should have probably gone to Spectrum, but just because of this divorce and, you know, house change and move and everything, I ended up going to Claremont.
Okay.
So complete new group of friends, you know, my comfort, everything was just kind of moved away.
So no dance. You've had this traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. You're now in a new school. Right. So right.
Kind
of sets the,
totally
sets the stage for, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then of course, like, you know, the boyfriend at the time, you know, told friends and the word that I had an abortion got around. So I ended up dropping out of school in grade 11. I was embarrassed
right.
and ashamed and really didn't work through the emotions of going through an abortion.
Right.
On top of that, I'd never told my dad. It was a big, like, secret. And as we know, secrets keep us sick.
Yeah.
I didn't really, mom offered to put me in counseling. She really did try to support me through it. I was young and I think counseling has to be a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, teenagers don't always look at that as an option. Right.
Yeah.
Just like that secret that I was keeping from my dad. And if he had known, it was just, yeah, it was a lot to carry, I think, at 16, to be honest.
Yeah. And not to be working through it in a, yeah.
No, in not a healthy way, right? Yeah. Like, I really shoved things down. Okay. At that time is when I started on antidepressants.
Okay.
And I unfortunately started drinking more. I was experimenting with ecstasy quite a bit, hanging out with older men, had a different friend group, like just total different path as opposed to what I was going and doing before, like dance and doing well in school and good friends, healthy right. friends, you know, like it was a total shift in direction.
Right. And after dropping out, I mean, was there any structure in your life or was it?
I definitely tried to do the side schooling, you
okay,
know,
sure.
I just didn't have the motivation to sit down and actually do it.
Right. Right.
I always worked. I got a job right as soon as I turned. I became like a teenager. So I worked quite a bit. McDonald's and all those lovely places. Right.
The teen jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to mom. Mom's kind of drinking started. I mean, she was going through her own stuff with the divorce and stuff, which was really hard on her. We didn't get along. Mom and I we really started to like butt heads at that time. I moved out at 17. With a girlfriend and my drinking just like catapulted, you know,
right.
more substance use. So there was, you know, use of like cocaine, just like right. dabbling with all
whatever,
kinds of
whatever
stuff,
you
right?
Get your hands on, yeah.
That was never really like what I enjoyed. It was always drinking that right. I came back to. Drinking was always my DOC. I found that like my whole life I was trying to run from who I was.
Right.
Right. Like I didn't like who I was. I didn't right. like this person. So I was either in a relationship with somebody or I was drinking or whatever it may be. I was always trying to hide.
Right.
Around let's say 20 or no, sorry, 19, I was dating a guy that was really into using cocaine, and we decided that, okay, we're partying too much. We're going to move away. So we moved to Smithers for a year,
to get away.
His brothers, one of his brothers owned a house up there. So we had a place to live, and we both moved there with the intention to stop partying.
Run away from the geographical cure, right? That's what it's called. 100%.
It was good in the grand scheme of things. Like, I felt like it was what I needed at that time. I was working 3 jobs. We got a dog. Like, it was a good experience. I really realized what I put my mom through. I remember calling her while I was up there and apologizing, telling her I was so sorry for all the things I had put her through.
Were you like sober in this stretch, or was just getting away from the cocaine and
we weren't using drugs anymore. I was still drinking, unfortunately, and there was a little bit of craziness while we were there. Yeah.
It's a little bit more settled then, right?
Yeah, just getting away from the island, right? Sure. I mean, when you're in that constant cycle of drinking and drugging with a group of people, sometimes it's just easier to step away.
Yes.
Not thinking that my problems would follow me, but they absolutely did, because that's, you know, it's internal. Yeah. At around, I think I had my 20th birthday there, and things with the boyfriend just kind of like blew up. He ended up cheating on me. And I ended up calling home to my family and heading back to Victoria. Going back to Victoria, I had this dog that I couldn't house because back then they didn't have pet deposits. So I had to give my puppy away, and that was a big loss. It was really hard on me. And then I remember going to mom one day asking or telling her that I think I had a drinking problem, and she kind of shoved it under the rug a little bit.
Interesting. So how old were you then?
I was 21.
21. And was this like a long time coming, or were you like, did you kind of have a moment where you're like, oh man, this is...
No, I was just like so sick of my shit, basically, to be honest. I was just like so depressed, had so much anxiety. I knew that I was going nowhere great and that I needed help.
And that's got to be hard when the first time you reach out, it kind of gets dismissed a little bit.
It does. Yeah. And I think I understand now that, you know, I'm further along in my journey of recovery that like mom was also struggling and it wasn't,
she didn't mean it.
I love my mom with all my heart, and absolutely. she's a sweet soul, and she didn't mean anything by it 100%. By any means. It was just that time and place. I think it was just not the right time. So what did I do? I went and enrolled in the CareAid program. Because I just didn't know what to do with myself. I was like, I got to do something, so I'll go and run away from myself again. And by doing that, I just thought that my focus would be more on that, right? Mm-hmm. And I had met my daughter's dad before enrolling in school and ended up getting pregnant. I found out the day that I started my CareAid program that I was pregnant with my daughter. I managed to finish schooling and graduate full-blown pregnant. And of course stayed sober during that time. Right. It was like a way to get away from myself and my drinking, of course.
Right.
I went to work as a CareAid when my daughter was 6 months old.
Wow.
Her dad watched her at home while I went to work, and work was great. I worked at Mount St. Mary Hospital for a while. I really loved it. It was good. But of course, you know, eventually my drinking snuck up again and things kind of spiraled. You know, you think, okay, I'm going to have a child, but really like it was like a jack in the box popped up and I was, oh my God, there's all my problems, right? Like,
So how long do you think, you know, after, you know, you had your kid, how long did you last?
I'd say probably like a couple months.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I was right back at her, right where I kind of finished off, right? Like it was this, So I spiraled and would drink to fall asleep. My relationship with her dad wasn't very healthy. It was very toxic.
Okay.
We weren't happy together.
Yeah.
His drug use started pretty heavily. Being a parent was hard. Yeah. I was still a child. It's I was only 22 when I had her.
Right.
Just
like you got grown up fast. It's
exactly. It hits you in your fate. Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot. Okay. So yeah, I would like literally come home from work, take care of my daughter, and then drink a Mickey to try to fall asleep, just because I had such shame and I was just so depressed. Obviously that wasn't helping anything. It was just like pouring gasoline on my depression and anxiety.
Compounds it all. Yeah,
totally. But our relationship spiraled. It just became more and more toxic, very abusive. I was obviously 50% of the problem. Like, it's definitely not my daughter's dad's fault entirely. We were just not right for each other. We split up in 2011. Separated, like, went our separate ways. He wasn't really a part of my daughter's life for a little while. He kind of went down a path of his own. Unfortunately going to jail. So we lost touch with him for a bit, but I managed to get into the Qantas House for Women with Children. Fleeing abuse is what landed us there. I stayed there for a year with my daughter. It was great. We did on-site counseling. It was just a really great organization. Within that, we got into subsidized housing and really started our journey. My daughter was 3 at the time, and that's when I finally got sobriety. I had gone to an AA meeting and the seed was planted. I knew that there were people out there like me and that I wasn't alone. I will say the God talk was a little overwhelming for me. I didn't really understand it. I didn't, just the way it was written, it was just it was confusing for me. I was also terrified of people at that point. Like, I just didn't have a lot of friends. It was scary for me to talk about myself in front of a large group of people, right?
Yeah, so it's just even getting into a room of people that you don't know and you don't know what to expect, right? Can be a scary idea.
I managed to.
But you did it.
Yeah. I did. I managed to stay sober for 6.5 years.
Just through the rooms alone, and was it like
not the rooms alone? Yeah. I literally went to a few meetings, and the seed was planted. But I did actually attend AOT, which is the Addiction Outpatient Treatment Center.
Absolutely.
I took the BSR and the ASR program. Learned about Umbrella.
Can you talk a little bit about the BSR and the ASR program?
BSR is Basic Skills to Recovery, and ASR is Advanced Skills to Recovery. Within that, we had group counseling. We had one-to-one counseling. We learned to meditate. I got to learn about what addiction was doing to my brain, to like my body, my mental health. It was just really interesting for me. I found that learning really helped me with my addiction and like my recovery. I read like maybe 100 self-help books. That was kind of like my focus. And also
understanding what's going on with you and some interventions that can,
And just like journaling. I was really into spirituality. Tarot cards, just connecting that way. I mean, my main focus was my daughter, was being there and being present for my daughter, because for the first 3 years of her life, I was a wreck, I was really just trying to survive and be there. So that 6.5 years was mainly about Shaylin and I. But during that time also, mom's addiction got a little bit more, it's almost like as it when I recovered, hers surfaced even more, because the focus wasn't on me anymore and my struggles. So I realize now that had I actually taken part in AA, maybe I would have actually seen, what was going on internally for me, and I could have worked through it a little bit better. I would have had some more community, and I wouldn't have felt so alone. Because I did. I felt really isolated even in that 6.5 years of sobriety.
So you're learning the skills, you were seeing success in your sobriety, but that connection piece was still missing.
I was young, I was only like 25 when I got sober. So at that age, I didn't really see a lot of people getting sober, and had I followed through with AA, that would have been very different. I would have actually seen that there's quite a few young people getting sober. I think I just was fearful of connection, in a sense. As much as I wanted it, I was fearful because of my own mental health and addiction, Yeah, I mean, and then
so you had 6.5 years. You're kind of building, but you're feeling like, you know, maybe that there's still some missing elements to your recovery. But at the same time, 6.5 years is really substantial, right?
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I grew a lot. Some stability. I learned a lot about myself, and I became very close with my daughter. Like, our relationship grew tremendously.
Right.
It's very healthy, and I thought I had it. I used to say, like, the only thing that would ever take me out is if something happened to my daughter. But unfortunately, as time creeped up, I ended up getting in a relationship with a gentleman that liked to drink quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And within 4 months, I was right back to drinking.
Wow. Okay. And that was, so was it like a 0 to 100, or were you just kind of like, just let the guard down, have a drink here and there? Or,
No, it was 0 to 100. It was as if I never had taken any time off at all.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Right. It was scary.
And was that night, was it like a, you know, the when you first did, you know, that first moment, was it, you know, kind of a conscious decision at that time, or did it just happen?
It was a conscious decision, but I was deathly sick the next day. Like, really, really, really sick. Like, yeah, really, really bad. And it just continued from there. First, it was like, oh, a couple. And then it was like, you know, a bottle. And then it just like escalated.
Right.
And that lasted about like 5 years, my relapse. Yeah, it was during COVID that it really catapulted.
And what, you know, was the landscape, you know, with your daughter at this point? Like, were you able to kind of, you know, obviously it would be hanging on for dear life kind of thing, or?
My daughter, yeah, it was hard. I feel like, I didn't even talk. I didn't even share that I had a son in that.
Okay.
I did have a son. Okay. I, at about 5 years sober, within that 6.5 years, I got pregnant with my son.
Okay.
And yeah, it was like quite a healthy experience, right? Because I had been sober for so long. It was really positive.
Right.
But what I didn't realize is how much my life was going to change going from being a mom to one to two.
Right.
And unfortunately, my daughter turned 9.5 and my son was 18 months old. That's when I relapsed.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's a big spread too. And you're kind of wearing a whole bunch of different hats as a mom at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the years to follow, I mean, like 5 years is a long time, especially being a mother and, you know, maintaining. Were you still working during that time?
During COVID, I was working as a care aide out in the community. So it was quite heavy, right? Going from house to house, and with people being sent home from hospital, and because it wasn't safe for them to be there with the COVID outbreak.
Right.
I was doing a lot more out of my scope, it felt like.
Sure.
There wasn't a lot of support. I didn't have like counseling or somebody to call with, you know, the struggles out in the community at the time. It was a big challenge. COVID, it spiraled me out of control. Like, I was just right back to where I was when I had been drinking at the beginning of my 6.5 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It was really bad.
And now it's just, right. Now you've got two kids that you're trying to, maintain in a job and trying to navigate through COVID. That's right. That's a lot to have
really
on your plate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then my daughter and I reconnected with her dad during this time. He was wanting to reach out to Shay and basically make amends with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we connected, and unfortunately, in 2020 August, he was murdered.
Oh, wow.
And that really just, my daughter and I spiraled from that, like, our relationship kind of fell apart, and that was during the 5 year relapse that I did have.
So you already weren't in kind of solid ground.
Yeah.
How old was your daughter at that?
My daughter was 11.
Oh man.
Yeah, it was really hard, right? Like, she really wanted that relationship with him, and unfortunately, like, didn't get the opportunity to rebuild it with him.
Right.
It was pretty traumatizing having cops show up and tell us that he had been taken, and it was, yeah, it's kind of what spiraled me out of control in those 5 years. Like, I knew that I needed to be present for my daughter and be strong, but for some reason I just like had lost the choice and couldn't stop drinking.
Right.
Like, my addiction had just it just had catapulted into like such a scary direction. I was I was consumed by it.
Man.
Yeah.
And I, obviously too, you know, like this is, these are some hard, there's something incredibly hard to try to process at the best of times. Mm-hmm. Right. And let alone, you know, in the middle, and this is at COVID at the same time. So there's all, that's a,
yeah, it was that, a
it's
lot.
Really we putting were... everything in just absolutely, you know, absolutely amplified then mm-hmm. at this point. Oh mm-hmm. man.
Yeah.
So what, you know, what got you, you know, to that point where you had to make that change? Was there a bottoming out or was there a...
Yeah, there was. There was lots of police presence, unfortunately, at my house. There was just like, I wasn't healthy. There was lots of like checks to make sure, wellness checks on me. Okay. Because I became really depressed, very suicidal. I had lots of suicidal ideation. I just felt like my kids would be better off without me because of my drinking and because I couldn't stop. Like I would, right. I would drink myself like, yeah, to oblivion. And then the next day be so physically ill that I would probably, I should have probably gone to hospital, but I didn't. And yeah, I just, it was really bad. It got to a point where my dad was diagnosed with cancer. In, I think it was 2021, I apologize. No, it was 2022. Sorry. Okay. And at that moment I realized that I really had to like get better. It was just, right. it was not good. My dad was worried sick about me. He knew that I needed help.
And where was he at with his substances at this point?
Dad was still drinking quite a bit. Yeah. He wasn't doing very well. Unfortunately never really went to the doctor, so right. He didn't realize how sick he was until it was too late. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed with cancer on my birthday.
Oh, sure.
And it was, yeah, it was hard. My auntie showed up to tell me, and I don't know, it was just at that moment I realized, okay, like I need to get my shit together. It's either I sober up or I'm going to die with my dad, basically. Right. My dad stayed with me a bit while he was doing his chemo. And that was really challenging for me. I decided that I was going to try to enroll in school to do the counseling therapist program.
Oh, wow.
Because I wanted to help people with addiction. But at the same time, I couldn't help anybody. I could barely help myself, right? I was still drinking. I was taking this course, having my dad live with me that had, you know, cancer, that was going through chemo treatments. And yeah, it was just, I was in complete delusion.
Right.
And I think at one point I had to write a suicide paper through the program. And that's when I kind of hit a wall. I was just like, I'm not okay. Like this is not going to work. I need help. Like I need to actually get help. Right. So I called Cedars, myself, and talked to, I think it was, Aiden at the time, right. And was like, I really need help.
So Cedars, recovery center on the island for those who don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Just... and yeah, my mom's boyfriend offered to pay the $30,000 to send me to treatment. And that was on a Tuesday I called, and on a Monday I was accepted. Right. So I was off to treatment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, and, you know, obviously, yeah, make sure the kids are doing okay. And then they actually have time to work on you and, mm-hmm. and give us, this is the first time that you've really done any inpatient treatment then. Hey?
Yeah. Like it was scary for me.
I
didn't really think that it'd be ever possible for me to leave my kids and go to treatment.
Right. Right.
So it was never like in my mind.
Right.
It was never an option.
So like not even detox, not, you know, so this was really it. This
yeah.
The first. Did you go to detox before you went, or you went straight up there? And
I just went straight up there.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And so what was your experience like at Cedars?
Cedars was lovely. It saved my life. I think it was exactly what I needed. I needed to step away from the chaos that I had created and really like look inward. Having my phone taken away and having a safe place to be with no distractions, no triggers was exactly what I needed.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot about myself. We did a set of steps. I got to realize, you know, some of my defects of character.
Okay.
Which I, yeah.
It's your first time working the steps.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. On-site, like lots of intensive counseling. I met, like, I really connected with people. I realized that it wasn't, you know, a bad thing to have community and have friends in recovery, that peers were actually exactly what I needed.
Right.
Okay, that I didn't need to go through it alone that first 6.5 years, that if I had community, I probably would have been a lot better off.
Right. So knowing. All of a sudden you have these people that you can kind of help support each other and right. That connection and community that's been mm-hmm. maybe that missing piece.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, obviously you put in this time, you had this great experience. Did you do the full 90 days or?
I did. Sadly, I went into treatment on my dad's birthday. So my sobriety date is my dad's birthday, which is pretty beautiful.
That's really special.
But I only ended up doing 42 days, because I got a call, unfortunately, that my dad was not doing well and that it was time to come home and say goodbye. So I left the Monday. I was supposed to finish on the Friday. I told my story at Cedars to my peers. I packed up my car and I drove straight from Cedars to the hospital to be with my dad and my two sisters. And we stayed there for about 4 days, and my dad passed away with me and my two sisters by his side. Wow. It was a gift, honestly, right. Because I got to see my dad and I got to tell him that I had finished Cedars and that I was sober.
Right.
So he passed away knowing that I had conquered, you know, this demon that unfortunately had really made him struggle through his life. So he was very proud and very happy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's a pretty emotional time and you're going through this new emotion, you know, set of emotions sober and, mm-hmm. and, you know, how did that transition look? A transition out of treatment is not always an easy thing. How was that experience for you?
I mean, it was kind of challenging to go from a place where it's like a safe bubble and you have these peers that have, you know, similar experiences that you can connect so deeply with. You know, you're really vulnerable in there. It's a beautiful place and you can be vulnerable. It's safe, right?
Yeah.
With counselors and staff. I think I found it kind of challenging when I left because I am a single mom to two. And I can't get to meetings every single day. Like, you know, that doesn't work with my lifestyle. So I tend to listen to lots of podcasts. I like to meditate. I like to read. But yeah, I mean, I may get to like one, maybe two meetings a week, but I'm not like a daily meeting person. I can't make it happen with my lifestyle.
And quite honestly, I think that's great to hear because I think, you know, sometimes there is this like all or none approach, you know, that you got to be hitting a meeting a day and hey, I love the idea of, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. But like you said, that might not be sustainable for a lot of folks. And for me, I kind of look at it a lot of times too, quality and sustainability over quantity, right?
Yeah.
What's something that I can actually is sustainable for me and what's, you know, what can I actually, you know, create some structure around it. It doesn't, you know, so I think that's great. So you're like going, okay, I can hit a couple meetings a week and I'm also going to do this and this. So you're creating a little bit of an individualized plan for yourself, which is great. I think everybody, you know, could benefit from doing that. Right. Mm-hmm. And finding what's going to work for them.
Yeah.
So you obviously found something that's going to fit into the limitations, you know, being a single mom and all that, you know, that, mm-hmm. that goes with that. So you found kind of a system that worked for you, but you're still keeping your head in the game.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, no, I think it's really important to do outside work as well. Like for me, I really needed, I was diagnosed with PTSD in treatment. And also I'm timid. I don't like talking in huge groups of people. So for me, I think talking to a therapist, by ourselves it was more therapeutic for me.
Sure.
I really could let it all out and knew that it would stay between me and that person. And yeah, it was just, I think it's really important to do that outside work. Right. Like AA is fantastic. Don't get me wrong. I agree with the program. I love it. I learned a lot about myself. I used to say like, it's like a map of yourself. The AA program, right. Doing the steps.
Yep.
And within it, I learned, like I said, a lot about myself, but there's a lot more stuff that I have to work on, and sometimes using or doing that work with the professionals is best.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's, it's, you know, pretty amazing because it's not always the experience, like getting out of treatment and then having it stick once you get back to community. That's hard because you're life kind of hits you in the face. Totally. And you're also getting out to the passing of your father and some emotional stuff. And you obviously found a system that worked for you to kind of keep it sustainable.
That's
amazing.
That's good. Yeah.
So you getting out of, so you going into Cedars, that's your sober date.
Yeah. So October 3rd, 2022 would be my sober date. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
And it absolutely feels different because I'm not alone, right? Like that first 6.5 years that I had, I was very isolated, but I didn't have to be. Like that was my lack of knowledge, knowing that like there are services and resources out there.
Yeah.
I think I was just young and I didn't know where to necessarily look. And then I also had alcoholism still surrounding me within my family.
Right.
So it was, yeah. But this time around, at least I know that I can go to an AA meeting, right? If I'm struggling, like that is a part of my toolbox.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think a few times, you know, that's why it looked like, hey, that relapse, it was a substantial relapse, but it's really, you know, shows that you learned from it and learned kind of what you had to do and built off of it almost. Right. And that's what I do say, you know, like, I think sometimes relapse can just hold so much shame and guilt, but it can also be a real tool of what what alterations you need to make to your, you know, program,
totally.
Right? So, and what you can do maybe a little differently and the things that you do need to watch out for. So it can be quite telling. And so I think that's amazing that you actually took that and found something to work for you. You found that connection piece, but you made it work for you a little bit.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Amazing. So, I mean... In this time, you were, you know, I know when I first met you, you were still working, and I don't know if you still are working as a care aide, or you've now transitioned into this world of Umbrella. What kind of gave you the idea now that, you know, you've got your sobriety, you're in a good place. What gave you the motivation to enter this field and to give back in that way?
Honestly, I was off for the first year of my journey back into sobriety. I was petrified to go back to work as a care aide, to be completely honest. I feel like it was very triggering going back to it just because, you know, it's hard. It's hard work seeing all these different illnesses that you might get as you get older. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a little intimidating. Also too, it's very hard on your body.
Right.
And I did 14 years of it. So I think it was just time to make a change. I remember I was reorientating with my care aide and I just was not feeling it. I was like in the orientation and I was like, you know, this just doesn't feel right. I was like, I really just don't want to go back to this job. So that day I reached out to Evan and was like, you know, I really would like to maybe volunteer for Umbrella just to give back and work with people that are also struggling because support's really needed. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, why don't you send me a resume? We don't have volunteer options, but you could potentially work here. And I said, oh, okay. So I went home, fixed up my resume and I sent it in and I had an interview. So yeah, right. I don't know. I remember when I did the AOT groups back when I was 6.5 years sober there, and I heard about Umbrella within that. So I had the thought of Umbrella in the back of my mind always.
Right.
And actually before heading to Cedars, I did reach out in a time of, you know, guilt and shame and despair. I was just, I was struggling one morning and reached out and called Umbrella office, and I had two outreach workers that I actually met with a couple times, but decided after that it was time for me to step away and go to treatment.
Right.
So yeah, I knew about Umbrella and I think it was just, you know, I never thought that I could work in a recovery type setting. I was like, oh no, it's just too close to home. I mean, I'm in recovery, but in all honesty, like this feels right. It feels aligned. It feels like it's a part of like my purpose. So that's kind of why I decided that maybe this was the right choice.
Right. Well, and I mean, I think it's always, for some people it's a little too close, you know, but at the same time, I think that there's something where you're really in the world of recovery and you're helping other people navigate those waters and, you know, seeing the struggles, but also seeing, you know, people rise above those struggles. And I think that that's really empowering for personal recovery as well. I mean, so now you've been in this field for a while, and I know that you've, you know, you're working on our surf team, which is an overdose follow-up team. And now you've jumped into the world of outreach where you're meeting people one-on-one, meeting people where they're at. And, you know, now that you're here, you're working, you know, you've had your own experience, you know, struggling and you're now trying to help people. What's, you know, what do you think is what do you see is lacking, you know, or what do you see could change in our current landscape right now? Like what's needed? Obviously this is a point where there's unprecedented struggles with substance use. You know, we see it everywhere. What are your thoughts, you know, from your vantage point of someone who's gone through it?
You know, I truly believe that there's a housing crisis, which we all probably agree with. I think that there needs to be more support when it comes to second stage housing for both women and men. There just needs to be more aftercare.
So, support of sober facilities or houses, essentially.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Addiction's a scary thing, right? And people shouldn't feel like they have to be alone. I really love the side of like being able to have support. And I think, you know, that's the true crisis right now is the addiction and like, or the, you know, like the housing crisis is, you know, you can't expect somebody to go off to treatment and then come back and have nowhere to like land safely.
No safe environment to get back to. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And we do see that right now. I think that's a constant, you know, concern of everybody, you know, working in the field or at least working through umbrellas. We see, people having the courage to go off and, you know, treatment's hard work.
It's a big decision. And
it's a big decision. Yeah. And you're putting in this time and you have the courage to make that change and not to have an option to come back to somewhere where you're safe and supported, knowing you're in a sober environment. Yeah, I agree with you.
I also think that Victoria would benefit from like more shelters that are dry.
Yes, right.
You know, safe shelters, maybe a women's shelter that's just dry. You know, I know they have the Salvation Arc program for men. Salvation Army, yeah, I think
Salvation
it is.
Army. Yeah.
But yeah, just like more options, you know. Right. I mean, the fact that Island Health, you know, has, you know, the regional beds and stuff is fantastic. But the reality is we need more second stage. Right. We need aftercare.
Right.
Planning. You know, you can't, treatment's not, you're not going to treatment and you're not going to be, or when you go to treatment, you're not going to come out healed.
Right.
Right. It's an ongoing process. Recovery is a it's ongoing journey. Right.
So taking that for, that's a one piece of the pie,
absolutely.
Getting to treatment, but what's that next step looking like for an individual? And, you know, I think we were talking before, you know, and struggles of finding, you know, a client, you know, coming out of treatment, finding a suitable second stage option and, you know,
affordability as right?
And
some people aren't working. Some people don't have, you know, that safety net of going back to a job.
Right.
And so, yeah,
what's that plan that we can put in place for somebody who actually is making those steps? Yeah. I think it's really, you know, discouraging. And I think if someone does come back, putting in all this time and effort, really making the stab at treatment, and then they come back to a, you know, unstable environment and relapse, what are the chances that they're going to do that again when they know that they kind of got failed?
Exactly. Really? Totally.
You know, it's going to be that much harder for them to make that step because they're like, man, is it just going to happen all over again?
Yeah.
So not knowing that they're supported throughout the continuum of their recovery. Yeah,
well, exactly. And people that, you know, have been on the streets, unfortunately, like they go to treatment and work, they're just expected to go back into the community and function like a normal, like an individual that's already used to being in the community. Right.
It takes time.
It does take time.
And support.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not easy. So I feel like it kind of has to have all hands on deck. You need support, period. We're in this together. Right.
No, I think that's great. I think you touch upon something that's desperately needed, at least, you know, in you know, where we're in Victoria. But I know that this is, you know, not just,
not just
isolated to Victoria. Yeah. This is more of a, you know, more of a problem that we see, you know, all over, at least in our neck of the world. So, well, thank you so much. I mean, because for me, that having, you know, your insight and knowing, you know, yeah, how hard that struggle is, you know, I really appreciate you being able to kind of, you know, yeah, raise that voice to what is needed. And also being in this line of work and giving back and having that relatability and you know, really being able to meet people where they're at, I think is so important. So,
yeah. You know, yeah. I will also say that, you know, it'd be nice to see, and I know this is hopeful thinking, but, you know, people being able to walk into like a detox and be like, I need help, you know,
now.
Or yeah, into right. emergency and saying like, I need help right now.
Right.
Because there are people that are in that like very vulnerable emotional state that are like ready right then and there to get yeah. help. And it's just not there for them.
Right. Yeah. Waiting six, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to enter detox. Well, that might be a very different individual that we're looking at 4 to 6 weeks
absolutely.
Down the line, right?
Yeah. Yeah, or it might be too late. You right. just never yeah. know. Like there is a huge crisis going on right now and it's very sad to see.
Yeah.
I also think that people need to be educated on addiction and mental right. health, you know, like professionals that are out there, first responders. Like I think that just opening up that knowledge, you know, right. and educating people that sometimes most of the time it's not a choice. Like people right. aren't out there like living, you know, their life to the fullest, right? And they're not right. out there having a blast and necessarily wanting to do this. They're doing right. this to stay alive and survive.
Right.
So I don't yeah. know.
I think
there's a lot of great. Judgment and it's right. very sad to see.
Right. Well, I always say, you know, I think there is a common misconception that, you know, people that are using that we see on the streets that they want to be using, they want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, lack of better options. And, you know, if you've tried and not been supported,
mm-hmm.
yeah, well, guess what? You're not, it's going to be that much harder. I think it's a really, really scary prospect to yeah. make that change and to, you know, and to, you know, seek sobriety. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, such a hard endeavor and knowing how hard that road is and how the lack of supports along the way. Well, it really, you know, yeah, it makes it a really challenging venture,
totally.
I think for people. So
well,
for people just
say,
think, hey, they want to be doing, you know, they want to be out there doing, no, I totally disagree well, with
and
that.
I always say too, it's like, you know, we don't shame somebody that has cancer, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
So why are we shaming people with mental health and addictions? You know,
right.
these are humans that have families that love them.
Right.
And they deserve the same respect, you know,
and supports
and support.
Interventions.
Yeah. yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, hopefully, you know, we're going to, you know, continue to advocate for change. And, you know, in the meantime, and I think that's something that's really important about this podcast too, is shedding the light on addiction. And
mm-hmm.
I'm, you know, I say this pretty much every time. I know it takes a lot of courage to come on and share and, you know, an intimate, you know, such an intimate account of your life and your journey. So, you know, I don't take that for granted. So I really appreciate you, you know, having the guts to come on here and do that. And I know it really does resonate with people. So
thank you so much for having me, Blake.
Yeah. And what do you think? It's, you know, once we kind of got rolling, right? It's not as nerve wracking.
Oh, it's a little yeah. nerve wracking.
Yeah. Well, I thought you did a great job. So yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, no, I appreciate all the work you do for Umbrella and our community.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks. Okay. Okay, thanks once again to Amy for coming onto this program. I cannot stress this enough. It takes a great deal of courage and a lot of confidence to come on to a program like this and share a story that's so intimate. And I just feel that Amy's authenticity and, you know, her genuine self really shone through in this interview. And that's all I really want when it comes to a guest on this program and these conversations. They need to be raw and they need to be real. I feel it hits, you know, so much deeper. We don't need a great deal of editing. We don't need polish. You know, what we want is real authenticity when it comes to telling these stories. So I really admire you, Amy, for having the courage to come on and being so real, you know, and sharing your story. So thank you again. And as far as Comfortably and Numb, the podcast is concerned, we have one more podcast coming to you in a couple weeks' time. And then we'll be taking a hiatus for the summertime, but we are going to keep these going. I think it's, you know, as I mentioned before, it's so important to have stories like this told to give us hope that recovery is possible, as we've seen time and time again. And, you know, I do like talking about the challenges that we're seeing in the field and the supports that are needed to you know, help people on their journey towards recovery. So we're going to keep on spreading the good word. One more podcast in a couple weeks' time. And until then, please stay safe and get in touch and reach out to Umbrella if you need supports. My name is Blake Anderson, and I'll see you in a couple weeks.